This is the Berkeley Signal.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Ha ha.
Michael, my dear.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. Fuck the apathetic bullshitter, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois que t'as senti le nom, tu t'allonges sur ton dos.
Yeah.
Tu es le défaut. Tu te manques des bulles. Tu t'enfonces dans ta
vie.
C'est important.
With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
NSA whistleblower, reality winner, has been sentenced to 5 years and 3 months in prison, the longest sentence ever imposed in federal court for leaking government information to the media. The 26-year-old reality winner is the first person to be sentenced under the Espionage Act since Trump took office. Her sentencing Thursday came after she pleaded guilty in June to transmitting a top-secret document to a news organization. Reality winner was arrested by FBI agents at her home in Augusta, Georgia, June 3, 2017, 2 days before The Intercept published an exposé revealing Russian military intelligence and conducted a cyber attack on at least one U.S. voting software company just days before the U.S. presidential election in 2016. The exposé was based on a classified NSA report from May 5, 2017, that shows the agency is convinced the Russian General Staff Main Intelligence Directorate, or GRU, was responsible for interfering in the 2016 presidential election. We're going to go right now to Jim Risen. Jim, you too were in the courtroom yesterday. Can you respond to the sentence that Reality Winner received?
I think it was outrageous. I think what has been done by the Trump administration to Reality is terrible, and it's one of the worst miscarriages of justice I've seen in a long time. What Reality Winner did was a public service. The disclosure of the document that The Intercept published, it provided a really important wake-up call to the American people that Russian intelligence was hacking into the election systems of states. And the Senate Judiciary Committee, in a report earlier this year, wrote that the Homeland Security Department had failed to adequately warn state election officials about the Russian hacking threat, and said in the Senate report it was only because of press disclosures that state officials began to be alerted to the Russian cyber threat, which shows that even Congress recognizes that what Reality Winner did was a public service. So I think one of the things that we at the Press Freedom Fund want to try to push for is to try to get the government to stop using this draconian espionage act against whistleblowers in the way that they have been. It's an archaic World War I era law that the government uses because it's so vague, you can charge almost anybody for anything. And it's not being used against spies anymore. It's only being used against people who actually talk to American reporters to reveal important matters.
In a recent sentencing memorandum, prosecutors argued Reality Winner deserved the unprecedented sentence because, quote, the defendant's unauthorized disclosure caused exceptionally grave harm to our national security. Jim Risen, your response.
That's just not true. If you look at the indictment of the 12 Russian intelligence operatives, virtually the entire information in there reveals that the Russian intelligence operatives that were targeted in this indictment were already aware as of 2016 that the U.S. was investigating them, and that they were alerted to that not by the leak to The Intercept, but by other actions taken by the U.S. government, and that the Russian official who was in charge of the hacking of election systems in that Russian unit had taken steps in 2016 to protect himself from American intelligence, which shows that a year before this document was published by The Intercept, other actions had already been taken by the U.S. government to alert the Russians that they were being monitored by the United States, which gives the lie to the idea that somehow anything that we published at The Intercept had anything to do with alerting the Russians about the American intelligence surveillance of them, and shows that there was no damage caused by this leak.
Earlier this morning, Jim, President Trump tweeted saying ex-NSA contractor should spend 63 months in jail over classified information. Gee, this is small potatoes compared to what Hillary Clinton did. So unfair, Jeff, double standard. Of course, referring to Jeff Sessions, who he wants to oust as attorney general. What do you make of this tweet? Because also, you could argue that this is a political attack on her because she was talking about Russian interference with the 2016 election, something President Trump doesn't like discussed.
Well, first of all, Donald Trump is a psycho and shouldn't be president. He's crazy. And so he tweets in the middle of the night about stuff he knows nothing about every day. So you have to discount this because of that. But he is correct that there is a double standard. It's just not a double standard with Hillary Clinton. The double standard is that low-level people in the intelligence community are the ones who are prosecuted and not high-level people. The real double standard here is between the way the Justice Department dealt with someone like David Petraeus, who was the CIA director who leaked lots of information to his former mistress and then was never sent to jail and was given probation, and the way that this draconian sentence against Reality Winner, which is an absurd double standard. That's the real double standard. The other thing I would say is that the thing that Trump doesn't want to admit is that he has politicized the Justice Department to such a degree that the two of the first three prosecutions of whistleblowers under his administration are about leaks of information about the Trump and Russia case. Both in this case, which involved the investigation of Russian election meddling, and in the case of Jim Wolf, the Senate Intelligence Security Officer, who has been charged with allegedly leaking information about Carter Page and the Russia investigation. So two out of three investigations are about matters that directly relate to Donald Trump and his campaign. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that the Justice Department has been highly politicized already on these kind of cases.
So you have Trump tweeting this comment about Reality Winner, talking about a double standard. And then you have the fact that Trump could pardon her. In fact, once he tweeted this, this was the response in social media saying, okay, pardon her. How likely is this?
Well, I think that would be great. I mean, that would show a level of mercy that we haven't seen from Donald Trump, but I think that would be great if he does that. She shouldn't be in jail in the first place. What she did was a public service. Anything that can be done to help her, I'm all for.
Talk about how this relates to your being head of the First Look Media's Press Freedom Defense Fund.
Well, we at the Press Freedom Fund, we've been very proud to help fund Reality's legal defense. It's one of the first cases that we funded since I took over the fund last fall. I think it's a real good case for Press Freedom because what she did, or what she's alleged to have done, as I said earlier, is a public service. And it really was one of the few moments in the last year and a half where the American people got a clear warning that their election systems were being hacked by the Russians. It was no longer just a hack of the Democratic Committee's emails. This was a direct hack of the American election system. The Russians were attempting to change voting patterns by getting into voting machines. And the United States government had failed to adequately warn anyone that that was going on until this document was released. The idea that that is somehow a bad thing is ridiculous. It shows you how absurd and Kafkaesque this entire prosecution has become. And so we've been very proud to help pay her legal defense.
Has this case changed the way The Intercept receives documents? And explain what she pled to. She mailed a document to The Intercept.
Can't really discuss how we handle things internally, but I think it's safe to say that this was important for us because it really was an important and great story. I think the idea that The Intercept, we receive actually quite a bit of anonymous information, and we continue to receive a lot of documents and other information from a number of sources anonymously and from people who are named. And so we're going to continue to always try to deal with that in the best way possible. I just came from the New York Times last year, and I can tell you that The Intercept handles material that is sensitive, that comes from sources, as well as any other news organization in the United States, and has a very high standard for the way in which they handle internal security on such sensitive matters, and will continue to do so.
Jim, you just wrote a piece this week called "Is Donald Trump Above the Law?" Explain and talk about your call for a Trump project.
I wrote in this latest piece that, you know, there's this longstanding tradition based partly on legal opinions issued by the Justice Department over the last few decades, in which it's believed that the Justice Department cannot indict and prosecute a sitting president, and that the only available option is impeachment in Congress. But it's clear now that the Republicans in Congress are not going to ever go along with an impeachment, no matter what Robert Mueller and the special counsel find. Even if the Democrats retake the House, and even if they retook the Senate, it's highly unlikely they would have the votes in the Senate for a conviction on an impeachment. And so the only real avenue, I believe, to deal with the criminality of Donald Trump is to indict him and prosecute him in a federal court. And I think that the prosecutors, both in New York, who have dealt with the Cohen matter, and Mueller's special counsel office, should both consider indicting him for what are very obviously criminal matters.
What do you think is criminal?
Well, I think this week what we got was Donald Trump's former lawyer admitting in court that the felony he just pled guilty to was a conspiracy that was coordinated and directed by Donald Trump. He said that in court. I mean, how does a federal prosecutor, when you have just prosecuted the man's personal lawyer and that personal lawyer has admitted that Trump directed him to do the thing that you just prosecuted him for, how do you then ignore that? As a prosecutor.
The Trump Project, Jim.
I wrote another piece about a week ago about, you know, when the American editorial pages were all writing about the need for press freedom in America. I said that we should really go further than just having a series of editorials. We need to have investigative reporters come together in a joint project to investigate Trump. Much the way that investigative reporters came together back in the 1970s in Arizona after investigative reporter Don Bowles was murdered in a car bombing by the mob. About 38 investigative reporters came from all over the country to jointly investigate what Bowles had been investigating and then wrote a series of stories about it. I think that's what we need with Donald Trump is to have investigative reporters from every major news organization getting together and writing to get jointly a comprehensive investigation of Trump that could be published jointly throughout the country as a sign of how strong press freedom and investigative reporting still is despite Trump.
Check yourself for collective identity, the kind that give rise to violent capacities for fascism in the 90s.
A recent poll by the think tank Data for Progress has found that contrary to establishment Democratic claims, strong progressive policies are a path to electoral victory. The data was published in a report called The Future of the Party and outlines in detail what policies most people who identify as Democrats actually support. Data for Progress describes itself as providing research, polling on left issues, and analysis to support activists and advocacy groups challenging conventional wisdoms about the American public that lack empirical support. John Green is my guest. He is the co-founder of Data for Progress. Welcome to the program, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I have to confess, I was quite happy to see that an organization like yours existed because you're right. We hear a lot of claims from Democrats about what it is that voters want, and they're rarely actually backed by data. We do have a lot of polling that's often done with very leading questions that end up offering results that are a little bit confusing to interpret. Was that the reason why you co-founded this organization?
One of the reasons. So this is actually the first poll that we've been able to fund and run ourselves. Up until now, we've been relying just on what's publicly available out there. And one of the things we've noticed in using publicly available polling is that the left's agenda, the policies that progressive candidates are running on, just don't make it into a lot of publicly available surveys because people don't think to ask them. I don't think that's like a conscious effort on the part of the people who are designing these surveys. They're smart people. They're putting together questions that they think people are interested in knowing the answers to. But we've seen recently a lot of energy within the progressive movement and among progressive candidates running on things like abolish ICE, Medicare for All, debt-free college, which we didn't get a chance to include in this survey, but we hope to in the future. And we just didn't know. Like, you know, pundits are out there claiming that these policies are going to be really problematic if they, you know, wind up on the Democratic Party platform on a national stage. And we just don't have any information on whether or not that's the case. So we're really excited to sort of branch out in this new project for us and start pulling the left agenda.
So how did you conduct your poll? How big was your sample? Give us a sense of the methodology and how confident you are in the results.
So we contracted with YouGov Blue, which is affiliated with YouGov. They're a very prominent pollster. And we got a sample of about 1,500 adults across the country, which we then weighted back to national demographics. So we're pretty confident. I mean, normally these polls are done with fewer respondents. We wanted 1,500 because we do some techniques to get state level estimates, which you need a little bit more respondents for. But for now, we're just publishing our national top lines. And we're very confident that these are, at least for now, where these numbers stand. So as candidates start running on these issues and they become more familiar to the electorate, you might see these numbers change.
Now, one of the things that jumped out at me was that people who identify as Democrats are very much embracing racial diversity and by extension want to see greater efforts towards racial justice. I suppose we shouldn't be too surprised because the demographics of Democratic Party voters and supporters tend to be more racially diverse than Republicans, right?
Yeah, that's the case. And that's a trend that's been increasing in recent years. So if you went back 10, 20 years, the sort of racial attitudes within the Democratic Party were probably more diverse. And now we're seeing the voters within the party becoming more committed to racial justice and making that link that if you identify as a Democrat, you should be adopting these more racially inclusive attitudes.
How did you ask the questions? What were the sets of questions that you asked your respondents? Did you do it issue by issue? Did you do it based on just simply asking them where they stood on certain broad-based issues or very specific questions?
For this round, we did a slate of policy issues. So the questions would typically be like, would you support or oppose on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being strongly support and 5 being strongly oppose? And then the proposal, right? So, you know, we have one that was a public option for internet. The wording was something along the lines of having a government-run internet company that would compete with private internet companies to fill coverage gaps in areas that currently don't have robust internet access. And so, you know, a slate of policy issues like that. So we have another one for providing generic versions of life-saving pharmaceutical drugs. We have a job guarantee question, universal basic income, ending cash bail for pretrial for people who are not flight risks or violence risks and things like that. So that was the general format, was support, oppose, on this policy proposal. This was a nationally representative sample. So we have Democrats, Republicans, Independents. Yeah, we were trying to get a picture of sort of the American adult population. We also have questions on who people voted for or whether they voted in the 2016 election. So we, our site, you can break down our respondents by people who say they voted for Trump or say they didn't vote, or a minor party candidate for that matter. But yeah, we wanted to get a sense of sort of the general population.
So let's talk about certain issues. Immigration is a huge one these days. The issue of family separation and the Trump administration's harsh anti-immigrant policies has led to calls of abolish ICE, which have been ridiculed by Democrats, but actually supported by some progressive Democrats. What did you find in your survey on immigration and where most Americans lie on that specific issue?
So abolish ICE at this point is certainly polarizing in the general public, but has plurality support among Democratic identifiers. So in a Democratic primary, the candidate who supports abolishing ICE, defunding ICE, whatever verb and ICE you want to put to change what that organization is doing and prevent those sorts of policy outcomes, that candidate is going to be on the right side of Democratic identifiers. So, you know, as the party is having this internal debate of like how hard a line do we want to take on what the Trump administration is doing to these families, this is another data point that this is where the base is, and the Democratic identifiers do not want to keep this organization around.
Your report points out that there is a much more favorable view that people who identify as Democrats have of the Black Lives Matter movement.
We didn't have a question directly asking about Black Lives Matter in this poll. We have a question on reparations, which is one of those, it's talked about relatively frequently at a low level, sort of, it's been discussed for quite a while. Very polarizing. So as you might imagine, white identifiers, Republicans, are very strongly opposed to policies designed to reverse the effects of slavery and Jim Crow. So it's polarizing. It is net unfavorable. The public in general was not in favor. But among young people and among people of color, and more so among Democrats, there are pockets of support for this policy. We note in our write-up that reparations on net are less unpopular than the Republican health care bill. It's not a rad idea by any stretch of the imagination.
What did you find on the attitudes toward expanding our current Medicare program from seniors to all Americans, which has actually become an issue in the midterm elections, and just a few years before Bernie Sanders' candidacy for president was a complete non-issue, was a non-starter?
This is a question we didn't include in this poll because it's been publicly polled and we've had data on it previously, and we were able to conduct this more granular state level analysis on it. And this is one of our relatively consistent findings, is that Medicare for All is popular pretty much everywhere. It's got very strong support nationally. It's got majority support in the median state. This seems like voters consider this to be at a gut level a good idea. People are not satisfied with healthcare as it currently stands.
In general, though, on government spending, on policies and programs that benefit ordinary Americans, what did your survey find? Because these days, the idea of socialism in general is becoming more popular. Socialism, you know, simply being government spending taxpayer money on behalf of taxpayers, programs that actually serve the needs of taxpayers. Did your polling find any particular direction where Democrats lie on government spending?
It really varies. So for some of these questions, for policies that will be expensive, we tend to include a clause in there saying this program will be funded by a tax increase on people making more than X amount of money. And we find that, you know, when you include that stipulation, support does drop a little bit because you're reminding people that, you know, we have to pay for these things. So in this case, we had a universal basic income question. Even on that question, at the national level, it was net negative two, right? So, you know, basically a coin flip as to whether or not an average American would support or oppose it. But among Democrats, it's popular, and it's certainly not a deal breaker for people. When you tell people that you have to pay for nice things, people still want nice things, I think is a fairly fair way to put it.
A big part of your report focused on non-voters. Let's talk about that. The establishment wing of the Democratic Party has long tried to win over centrist voters from the Republican Party to their party. Is that losing strategy?
I don't know if it's a losing strategy. I'm not sure that we have to choose between winning swing voters and winning non-voters. This is a big debate in the political science community as well over whether swing voters exist in meaningful numbers, whether mobilization efforts among non-voters are a more valuable use of campaign resources. These issues can be treated relatively independently to a certain extent. Certainly the kinds of policies and proposals that would win Your sort of Romney Republicans, your suburban pro-war, high-income Republican voters are probably going to turn off non-voters who you need to win an election. But one of the things we're finding in our polling here is that policies like public option for internet, generic pharmaceutical drugs, ending cash bail have support in rural areas and among lower-income white voters who probably voted for Trump in 2016 and who are open to a robust economic agenda from progressive candidates.
Your report says that only 34% of individuals who identify as Democrats voted in all three elections between 2012 and 2016. It sounds like the Democrats have a problem of mobilizing their own voters.
Yes, definitely. Particularly because this is a coalition that relies on low-income, younger, and more mobile voters who face structural barriers to turning out to vote. You know, voter registration deadlines are, in particular, are a real impediment to people who are moving a lot. So this is going to disproportionately affect Democrats' abilities to mobilize their own base. So giving them a reason to come out and vote, I think, is particularly important for progressive candidates. You got to get people excited.
Is there anything in a report that suggests that adopting bold progressive policies would actually help mobilize more voters to vote for Democrats?
All we have right now is evidence showing that non-voters like these ideas. So, you know, non-voters are, in particular, this is all correlated with being low income, younger. These are all factors that predict, you know, being more likely to support bold progressive policies. So right now we just have this correlation. People who didn't vote previously, like progressive agenda, has to be tested. Candidates have to take that bet that if they promise to improve these people's lives and follow through on it, then they'll be rewarded at the polls.
Poor people don't vote very much, as per your report. And I want to discuss that. Your report points out that the preferred candidate of the poor was no one in the 2016 election, with nearly one in two not voting. And that if low-income non-voters, meaning people just don't vote but are eligible to, would overwhelmingly prefer Democrats if they voted and would have been more than enough to shift the election outcome in favor of Democrats. But, of course, if the policies that the Democrats are adopting favor wealthy people, there's no good reason for poor people to vote for them, right?
I think there's a very real perception in low-income communities that the Democrats don't meaningfully address their core economic concerns. I think that's perfectly fair to say. I think it's still fair to say the Democratic Party, as it stands now, for all of its flaws, is better than the Republicans. But that's if you are struggling to make ends meet, that's not a very compelling reason to come out and vote for the least bad option. So, yeah, I think in order to make a credible case to low-income communities that they have something meaningful to gain from voting for Democratic candidates, you're going to need to see a real change in substance and tone and respect for these low-income communities who are not wrong when they say that Democrats have not made the necessary efforts to make their communities better.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
course, with this, I'd like to call up Mr. Andrew Pasta.
Possible impeachment of Trump is growing in Washington after Tuesday's stunning legal developments. In New York, Trump's longtime personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to 8 criminal charges, including tax evasion, bank fraud, and campaign finance violations. 200 miles away in Virginia, Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, was found guilty of 8 charges related to tax and bank fraud, as well as hiding a foreign account. The Cohen case is likely to put the president in the most legal jeopardy. Michael Cohen worked for Trump from 2006 until this year. He admitted in court he arranged to illegally pay out money to 2 women, an adult film star and a Playboy model, to keep them from speaking during the 2016 campaign about their affairs with Trump. Cohen said the payments were made, quote, in coordination with and at the direction of a candidate for federal office, and that they were made, quote, for the principal purpose of influencing the election, unquote. Cohen's lawyer, Lanny Davis, wrote on Twitter, if those payments were a crime for Michael Cohen, then why wouldn't they be a crime for Donald Trump? Davis later appeared on MSNBC and said Cohen's willing to speak with special counsel Robert Mueller about, quote, a conspiracy to collude with Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign. Davis also told The Washington Post Cohen knows about Trump's participation in a criminal conspiracy to hack into Democratic Party officials' emails during the 2016 election. Michael Cohen becomes the fourth former Trump official to plead guilty to criminal charges. He joins former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, Trump's former deputy campaign manager Rick Gates, and former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos. Michael Cohen will be sentenced on December 12th. He'll likely be sentenced to 4 to 5 years in prison. Meanwhile, in Virginia, a jury convicted Paul Manafort on 8 of 18 charges, but the jury could not reach a verdict on the other counts. Sentencing experts expect him to receive a prison term of about 10 years. The Manafort charges stem from special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election, but the case against Manafort focused on the work he did before he became President Trump's campaign manager. Manafort was accused of hiding millions of dollars earned in Ukraine and overseas bank accounts and failing to pay taxes on the money. The question now is whether Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort will cooperate with Mueller's investigation in exchange for lesser sentences, or will Trump pardon one or both men? To help answer these questions and more, we're joined by investigative journalist Marcy Wheeler. She runs the website EmptyWheel.net, joining us from Michigan. Marcy, welcome to Democracy Now! An epic day yesterday when two of Trump's closest advisor, fixer, his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and his former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, both guilty. Talk about the verdicts yesterday.
Yeah, it's not often we need a split screen for a guilty verdict. Usually that's reserved for sporting events. But the Manafort guilty verdicts were pretty much expected because the case against him was a slam dunk. It was tax fraud. It was some bank fraud. The charges that the jury was not able to reach a verdict on involved charges where Rick Gates's testimony was central. So it seems like some people on the jury may not have found him all that credible. And also one charge where Trump says it didn't involve him. That's not actually true. There was one charge where Manafort was trying to get a loan in 2016 from a banker in Chicago and promising him positions once Trump took the White House. The impression is the jury decided that Manafort was going to get that loan regardless of what kind of claims he made to the banker. And so those are the charges that he wasn't found guilty on. But they're both tax cheats. They're both involved in other crimes. As you emphasized, the very interesting thing for Trump are the two hush money payments involved with the Cohen crime, because there he quite clearly said, and the criminal information said, I think it was the 46th word in the criminal information, named Trump, basically, didn't name him by name, but said, you know, the person went on to become president, and named him as being part of the conspiracy to pay off these women so as to hide these affairs for the election. In his statement in the courtroom, he was very clear that he did this with the involvement at the behest of Trump. So while the Russian investigation is going to name Trump, and technically sort of did in the GRU indictment, it made it clear that he asked for Russia to hack Hillary and they immediately did. But here he is named explicitly. So it's the first time in these wide-ranging legal investigations that he is being named and being accused of committing a crime to cheat to get elected, basically.
Well, let's go to Michael Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis, speaking Tuesday night on MSNBC.
Mr. Cohen has knowledge on certain subjects that should be of interest to the special counsel and is more than happy to tell the special counsel all that he knows, not just about the obvious possibility of a conspiracy to collude and corrupt the American democracy system in the 2016 election, which the Trump Tower meeting was all about, but also knowledge about the computer crime of hacking and whether or not Mr. Trump knew ahead of time about that crime and even cheered it on. And we know he publicly cheered it on, but did he also have private information?
Now, that's Michael Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis. Talk about the significance of what he's saying and what kind of information he's offering to Mueller.
Well, it's not actually clear. Cohen has been pursuing a cooperation agreement for well over a month, probably a couple of months, and Mueller did not take him up on that, at least as far as has been made public. Clearly, Cohen implicated Trump in hush payments, but he has not, as part of yesterday's plea agreement, he has not publicly implicated Trump in any of the Russia-related crimes. So I'm not convinced that this guilty plea is more important than Manafort's guilty verdicts yesterday, because Trump a long time ago said, I think I'm okay so long as Paul Manafort doesn't flip on me. Manafort is the only one who can really bring me down. Because it is true, or Cohen claims that he knows information about when Trump knew certain things about the hack and leak. But even Omarosa says that she already talked to Mueller's people about that. So it's possible. I mean, several things are possible, Amy. One is that Cohen's right, and he will go talk to Mueller, and he will get some lesser sentence because he does it. It's possible that Mueller doesn't need Cohen's cooperation, and Mueller wants to indict Cohen for part of the conspiracy as well. And it's possible that Mueller just doesn't want to cooperate with Cohen because he's been spending so much time talking to the press. We know that he, with George Papadopoulos, for example, as soon as Papadopoulos went to the press, he stopped trying to cooperate with Papadopoulos entirely. So we don't actually know. What we do know is that according to Trump's own understanding of the circumstance, for whatever that's worth, Paul Manafort is the one person who can bring him down. Now, Rick Gates has been cooperating since February, and Rick Gates knew most of what Paul Manafort knew. And Rick Gates is the only one of the many people that you said, that you described as who had already pleaded, who got a very sweet plea deal. I mean, he got excused from all of the financial crimes that Paul Manafort was found guilty of yesterday, some other ones in D.C. He was excused from some of his own role in the conspiracy with Russia. So Rick Gates, as far as we know, is the one who's offering the big cooperation. And that puts both Cohen and Paul Manafort on much shakier grounds if they believe they're going to get a lesser sentence by cooperating with Mueller.
Who exactly is Lonnie Davis, which is very interesting. Michael Cohen has chosen him as his lawyer, the former Clinton legal advisor.
Lanny's function here is not to be a lawyer. Cohen's got a different lawyer who used to work in Southern District of New York. That lawyer was picked because he knows the people who were prosecuting him in New York, and he has the ability, to the extent that it's possible, to negotiate a plea deal. Lanny Davis's job is to go on TV and make statements like he did yesterday. That's really been his function for a long time now. He's in some ways the Democratic equivalent of Paul Manafort. He's about press these days more than he is about lawyering. But again, I'm not sure that working the press is going to get you a plea deal with Robert Mueller. He has made it very clear he doesn't want any of this in the press. He doesn't want to work via the press. He's been unbelievably good at not leaking anything. And so hiring a Democratic lawyer to go and appear on TV and make allegations about the president isn't necessarily going to help Cohen's legal plight at all.
And what about Burr and Warner, who are heading up the Senate committee that is investigating Russian interference, saying that this might influence what Michael Cohen has said, might want to question him, and what this means, Michael Cohen going before Congress?
So Cohen already testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and there he said he didn't know of any prior knowledge of the June 9th meeting, and some of the public statements that he and Lanny Davis have made seem to contradict that. And so yesterday, the Senate Intelligence Committee, in the wake of this plea deal, basically contacted his lawyers and said, does his prior testimony before the committee, does it still hold? And they've threatened to call him back to test the claims that he's made before. You know, I'm a little bit jaded about what Richard Burr is doing here. The investigation, yes, it is credible. Yes, it is bipartisan. There are only seven people investigating it, according to public reports. They're still working on reviewing what the Intelligence Committee knew by January 2017. So they're not getting to the guts of whether there really was collusion. So it's sort of Richard Burr's job to go and test these claims and go on TV and claim that there was no collusion, rather than to really get to the core of whether there was or not. And I think that's more of what's going on here than really trying to get to the bottom of things. But we will, because the Senate Intelligence Committee already got testimony from Michael Cohen, we will learn quickly whether he's backing off his prior testimony. Back in January or February, the New York Times actually reported that Trump had preemptively offered both Mike Flynn and Paul Manafort pardons. And a lot of what has happened in the Manafort case, you sort of have to believe that, because yesterday's verdicts were not a surprise. The case was overwhelming against him. And so it was sort of suicidal for him to go through trial because his sentence will be much stiffer. I mean, just as a comparison, as you said, he is expected to get at least 10 years, whereas Cohen is going to get five or fewer. Similar kinds of crimes, right? So for having gone to trial, Manafort's going to get twice the sentence. And so one of the most logical explanations for that is he's expecting a pardon. But because Mueller already knows, in fact, this is one of the questions that he wants to ask Trump, apparently, Mueller already knows that this pardon has been offered preemptively, I think that that would count as obstruction of justice. It's also not that easy to do well. The last time we were in this kind of situation, George Bush commuted Scooter Libby's sentence right when he was about to go to prison. And that meant that Libby wasn't going to prison, but also still retained his Fifth Amendment privilege against testimony. That's the kind of thing he would have to do with Manafort. And it's not clear that that would be enough to silence Manafort going forward. Because if he pardons Manafort today, then Manafort can be asked to testify without incriminating himself on the Russia stuff, which is what Trump has already said is what Manafort is most threatening to him for. So it's sort of hard to do. He's pardoning everyone anyway, but it's not clear that that's going to achieve the objectives that he really wants, which is to skate free of what he himself has done with multiple conspiracies. I mean, there's the conspiracy to silence the women and the conspiracy to work with Russia to win the election. So now we can speak in multiple terms.
Trump's current personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, said in a statement, there's no allegation of any wrongdoing against the president and the government's charges against Mr. Cohen. It's clear that, as the prosecutor noted, Mr. Cohen's actions reflect a pattern of lies and dishonesty over a significant period of time. On Sunday, Giuliani appeared on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd to defend Trump. Marcy Wheeler, I want to go step further to this issue of impeachment and what can happen here. We are so close, 11 weeks away from the midterm elections. Also, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, they're trying to push him through before the election, the possibility of a flipping of the House or the Senate or the House and the Senate. But what about this possibility of impeachment?
Well, we don't know. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, both of those clips are him playing games. Neither of those are credible. It's not clear he even understands the legal risk that the president is under. He really should stop being invited on TV to go and just play with the press because he's not providing any news or anything credible. But Mueller knows that. Mueller knows that Rudy is playing games. Mueller knows that Rudy is trying to stall. Mueller knows that Rudy is trying to stall long enough to get Kavanaugh confirmed. And so we don't know, and Mueller is not telling, what he plans to do in response. One of the things that was interesting and less newsworthy yesterday is he extended the continuation of Mike Flynn's sentencing, but only until September 17th, which is shorter than any of the other extensions, continuations. And so that suggests that Mueller's got some things up his sleeve in the next 24 days. And I wouldn't be so surprised to expect some major moves from Mueller while Rudy's on TV kind of playing with the press and uttering nonsense. So we don't know what's going to happen. I'm sure Mueller recognizes the risk of the stall games that Rudy and Trump are trying to play. I guess we just wait to see how Mueller's going to respond to that.
Marcy, before we end, I wanted to ask you about your personal connection to the Mueller probe. Last month, you wrote, quote, "Sometime last year, I went to the FBI and provided information on a person whom I had come to believe had played a significant role in the Russian election attack on the U.S. This led you to being a witness in Special Counsel Mueller's investigation. Explain."
I went to the FBI about something that was not part of the Mueller investigation. And as I understand it, it subsequently got moved under the Mueller investigation. So, yeah, I've got a little bit of insight into things that are not yet public about people unrelated to Trump. I did in that post note that the person in question knew what Trump was doing within 15 hours of the polls closing in 2016 after the election. But beyond that, I can't really explain what the person that I went to the FBI about did. It does lead me to believe that there are a lot of things about the Mueller inquiry or the things that are now under Mueller's investigation that people just aren't aware of in public and that I think will surprise.
Explain further what you did explain publicly.
I went and talked to the FBI about something that I believed this source had done, roles that I believed he had played in the election. And the way I did it was in part an effort to protect my other sources and to protect my readers, because I believed if I had not done that, the FBI would come and start getting call records for everyone who goes to my site. I went to them and I said, you can have this, but, you know, I'm not going to talk to you about any of my other sources or any other journalists or what have you. So it was sort of a preemptive effort to stop what I viewed as somebody doing ongoing damage without impacting my other equities, I guess. It was clear at the time I made the decision to go to the FBI that he was engaged in ongoing serious damage and hurting innocent people. So I felt like I could not stay silent about that any longer. But I also felt like I couldn't go to the press. I couldn't just publish it because, in my understanding, that would probably exacerbate things. It would lead him to do something unreasonable, and it might lead to increasing the damage rather than decreasing it.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
In the winter of 2017, seven people were arrested in Florida for the crime of serving food to homeless people in a public park. Media didn't take much notice, though one Wire report explained that while you might think feeding the hungry sounds good, it's, quote, actually a legally complicated matter that could violate laws and even send you to jail, close quote. Counterspin asked Megan Hustings, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless, for some background on food sharing and what municipalities that criminalize it are hoping you'll misunderstand.
What's key about food sharing, especially as Food Not Bombs tends to do it, which is going out into the community and to parks where people congregate, is that it finds people where they are. We have a longtime advocate who is homeless himself who always says that homeless people are the least lazy out there because they have to walk 2 miles from the shelter to get their lunch and then 2 miles back to get dinner and come back at night. Oftentimes, even though there might be free food or meals available, they're not always convenient for folks who are staying outside. So those who do feed in public areas like parks are providing a very needed service.
Well, let's talk about the pushback on that, because what one gets from the media coverage, which of course is kind of thin and occasional, is, oh, sure, it sounds like a good idea, but there's really these actually very good reasons that it's not a good idea. What forms do the restrictions tend to take?
They can take many forms. The restrictions that we know about have been anywhere from requiring a permit, which I believe is what is on the books in Tampa, a permit to share food, and sometimes that requires that you do it actually indoors or have some sort of facility where food prep is highly regulated. Orlando had a law on the books that said that you could not share food with more than 25 people in public places, so that folks were getting arrested when they handed out that 26th sandwich. In general, these ordinances have been around for a very long time. We've been tracking them for about 20 years. And what we see is that, in general, what communities are in effect doing is making homelessness less visible. Even though that might not be the outward intention, that's usually what happens. And in the case of Tampa, we have to mention that there was a large college football event earlier this week. And so it was odd that even though there had been a law on the books for a very long time that police and the city had not responded by asking the Food Not Bombs folks to move along until there was the event that a lot of people would be paying attention to in the city and perhaps wanted not to see this kind of sharing of food or these, you know, quote-unquote types of people in their city.
There seems to be this idea that somehow helping homeless people in this sense and feeding them is creating or driving homelessness, as though if you didn't feed them, they wouldn't exist?
We find that very troubling, you know, especially troubling because homelessness has so many causes. And, you know, something that we have really highlighted in recent years with the increased number of encampments that are springing up across the country is, first of all, there's not enough affordable housing in our communities, but also there's just not enough shelter either. And unfortunately, even federal funding has been, in recent years, kind of tailored more towards permanent supportive housing programs, which are extremely successful and really doing a great job of housing small number of folks. And so there's a lot more people who are just not finding the resources or the help that they need on a daily basis. But again, I think what we see is not just restrictions on feeding, but also there's been lots of laws that restrict camping or sleeping, even sitting down in public places, you know, sitting on sidewalks or even benches. There's not just ordinances, but also subtle things that cities do, like putting armrests in the middle of public benches so that you can't lay down. Here in D.C., we have bus stop benches that have little dividers between the seats, and they're very, very skinny, so it would be very difficult to lay down and be comfortable. So there's these little things here that are subtly saying we don't want to see people who are homeless in our cities and our downtown areas. You know, we're trying to move them along in any way we can. And we just think that this is really antithetical to ending homelessness and truly doing something to help people get off the streets. And we understand that there's a lot of cities, mayors, who get a lot of feedback from their community that homelessness is a large problem, but we're not going to solve it by saying you can't be homeless here. That's not looking at all at the causes of why somebody is homeless or really what the issues are that are preventing them from getting and affording long-term housing.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I guess folks who are motivated to do things, we're all going going to have to decide what our relationship to the law should be when mm-hmm. we disagree with those laws. That's going to be a choice that I guess more and more folks are going to be making. Let me ask you, are there not things that municipalities themselves can do? You know, we hear about places making themselves sanctuary cities, you know, so maybe mm-hmm. there's going to be a federal law that's pressing deportation, but we're going to make a statement that in our community, we're going to do things differently. Are there those sorts of tools available in terms of homelessness and feeding hungry people?
Most definitely. You know, the root of homelessness is the lack of affordable housing. Communities across the country, we're all struggling to find housing that we can afford. So that's kind of at the basic level. We really need more advocacy from folks, calling your legislators. They really do actually want to hear from you. And being involved in advocacy efforts to really increase funding for affordable housing programs. There's also a number of cities who have endeavored to support encampments and folks who live in them while longer-term housing solutions are found. So there are some encampments across the country who have agreed to, you know, do things like trash pickup and mail delivery services even, you know, anything to provide the higher standard of living for folks who only have the ability to live outdoors or there's not a viable option for them to be indoors at the moment. That's definitely something that we encourage. If there's more of a realization that there are positive things we can do to ultimately end homelessness while also supporting those individuals who are on the streets right now, that's much preferable to the alternative.
We've been speaking with Megan Hustings, director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Find their work online at nationalhomeless.org. Thank you very much, Megan Hustings, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
All I want is the truth. They'll just give me some truth. All I want is the truth. They'll just give me some truth. I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. And just give me some truth. No short hair, yellow belly, son of Tricky Dicky's got a mother of a soft soap beat with just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough. Sending mama's little chauvinist. All I want is some truth. Well, just give me some truth. I've had enough of watching scenes of schizophrenic, egocentric, paranoid prima donnas. Just give me the truth. Well, just give me some truth. No short hair.
just give me some shoes. All I want is some truth. Girl, just give me some truth. All I want is the truth. But just give me some truth. All I want is the truth. But just give me some truth.
We end the hour looking at how multiple people close to Donald Trump have direct ties to white supremacists. Trump's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, has admitted he recently hosted white nationalist publisher Peter Brimlow at a birthday celebration at his home. Brimlow founded the anti-immigrant website vdare.com. Meanwhile, Trump's speechwriter, Darren Beatty, was fired last Friday as revelations surfaced that he'd spoken at a conference alongside prominent white nationalists, including Brimlow, in 2016. Beatty was a panelist at the H.L. Mencken Club Conference, an event the Southern Poverty Law Center calls a gathering of, quote, white nationalists and pseudo-academic and academic racists.
For more, we go to Montgomery, Alabama, where we're joined by Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Richard. Talk about these latest developments.
Well, I don't think they're entirely surprising, Amy. You know, we've seen a real cross-fertilization between, you know, some hardcore people in the anti-immigrant movement and the Trump administration. You know, Jeff Sessions, Stephen Miller, and, you know, now these revelations. So it's a reflection of Trump, his policies, and his heart. These people aren't renegades. You know, they are not people who weaseled their way into the administration and corrupted Trump. They reflect his views. He chose them because of their views. And I think it's a sad state of affairs.
Well, talk about who Darren Beatty was, speaking at the H.L. Mencken Conference and what that was.
Sure. The H.L. Mencken Conference is, you know, kind of an incubator for alt-right ideas. People like, you know, Richard Spencer was one of its founders. They have an assortment of, you know, kind of academic racists who speak there every year, including people like Peter Brimlow. And it's quite incredible that Darren Beatty, a speechwriter for Mr. Trump, would have been there in 2016. You know, he gave a speech that was really music to the ears, I'm sure, of his audience. It was very Trumpy. It was kind of an anti-globalist speech. He talked about globalism as one of the things that was responsible for the errors, as he put it, of immigration. And he talked about movement conservatism being dead and a new form of right-wing intelligentsia emerging. And I know that that was music to the ears of the racist who listened to him.
Stephen Miller is, of course, still in the Trump administration. And explain what VDARE is.
Well, VDARE is a website that Brimlow started. And really, it's a publishing platform for white nationalists. People like Jared Taylor, someone who said that, you know, black people weren't capable of forming a civilization. He was the spokesperson for the organization from which Dylann Roof drew the idea that there was a genocide afoot against white people. So, I mean, I think it's been a mouthpiece for the radical right, white nationalism, anti-Semitism for almost 20 years now. Brimlow was actually someone that Stephen Miller and Richard Spencer brought to Duke University when they were both students there. Miller was an undergraduate. Stephen Spencer was a graduate student. And some people say, and there's some evidence for it, that Spencer was kind of a mentor for Stephen Miller during that time.
And where do you see this going, Richard Cohen? I mean, you've expressed concerns about, obviously, the white nationalists who are in the White House. But talk about what's been going on outside as well. I mean, in different places around the country.
Well, you know, I'm more concerned, of course, with white nationalism within the administration than I am outside of it. After Charlottesville, we saw some of the players who had been prominent there, you know, kind of retreat into the background from the bad publicity as a result of Heather Heyer's death. We saw the tech industry clamp down on them. And at the same time, we saw new emerging elements of the white supremacist movement come to the fore, particularly in the Northwest, places like Portland, Seattle, with the rise of a group called the Proud Boys.
I wanted to ask you about what happened on a recent tweet. Trump tweeting, "I have asked Secretary of State Secretary Pompeo to closely study the South Africa land and farm seizures and expropriations and the large-scale killing of farmers. Then he quoted Fox News' Tucker Carlson saying South African government is now seizing land from white farmers. Former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke and the far-right anti-immigrant website VDare.com retweeted the president along with messages about white genocide. The South African government then responded, and they wrote, quote, South Africa totally rejects this narrow perception which only seeks to divide our nation and reminds us of our colonial past. Again, this coming just after Trump's speechwriter fired after it was revealed he'd spoken at a white supremacist conference. Talk about this latest attack on South Africa and what it means.
Well, look, Trump has a history of tweeting racist themes, racist ideas. The idea that he would pick out South Africa from all the countries that have problems in the world is quite incredible. You might remember Dylan Roof, the person who massacred 9 people in a church in Charleston, had the emblem of the former South African regime on his coat, as well as the emblem of the former regime in Rhodesia. And of course, he believed that there was a white genocide afoot. So Trump tweeting this kind of thing is, again, really playing into the hands and energizing the radical right, as evidenced by tweets of people like David Duke that you mentioned.
And, of course, he tweeted this right after there was a segment on Fox News. Finally, we just spoke with Professor Johnson in North Carolina, the only African-American woman dissenting vote on keeping the Confederate monuments on this first anniversary of the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville and the vote to keep these monuments. You've done so much work at the Southern Poverty Law Center on the significance of these monuments, and they voted to keep these monuments on the Capitol grounds in North Carolina 2 days after the students at UNC toppled the Confederate monument there, Silent Sam.
Yeah, you know, there are probably about 1,500 Confederate monuments, markers, even some army bases named after Confederate generals. And it's really the country needs to come to terms with this racist past. I mean, these monuments were erected as basically a celebration of white supremacy at the turn of the last century, and then again during the height of massive resistance to desegregation in the 50s and 60s. They ought to come down.
There are even 10 U.S. military bases, as you point out, named for Confederate military heroes.
These people were treasonous folk. They were fighting against the United States. And the idea that we name military bases after them is incredible. And, of course, it's a reflection of the power of the Southern senators in a bygone era.
Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to dive into the backstory of Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump, and Russian oligarchs. My guest is Craig Unger. So Lanny Davis yesterday, who is the attorney for Michael Cohen, said in a number of different television interviews that Michael Cohen may have information that could be of interest to Robert Mueller over whether Trump knew about the hacked emails of the DNC server. That gets sort of back to the beginning of what all this investigation is about, and whether or not he would have information for Mueller about whether or not Trump knew about this even before the hacked emails themselves became public. I certainly don't expect you to tell me what is that information, but you do write a lot about Michael Cohen in your book, House of Trump, House of Putin, as well as Paul Manafort. We're going to dive into both of those. But maybe you could talk to me about what do you know about what Michael Cohen knows about Donald Trump?
Michael Cohen is a very interesting character. And I think we've seen with Cohen and Manafort, two pieces of the puzzle are starting to reveal themselves. I think most Americans don't know that much about Michael Cohen. A lot of it hasn't come out. But we're also going to see dozens and dozens of other people come out of the woodwork as well. And with Michael Cohen, he has been at the nexus of the relationship between the Russian mafia and Donald Trump for quite some time. If you go back many, many years, he and his family owned a restaurant social club called El Karib, which has been the center of operations in Brooklyn for the Russian mafia. So that goes back a long time. I know at least that Michael Cohen has been close to Felix Sater, who was managing director of a real estate development company that partnered Donald Trump in real estate deals. And he also allegedly has had ties to the Russian mafia. So you see this from the very beginning. I go back more than 35 years to 1984, when for the first time you see Donald Trump meeting with someone close to the Russian mafia. He comes in with $6 million in cash, buys five condos, and there you have it. He has laundered money because Donald Trump asks no questions. And what I learned again and again is that Donald Trump loves doing business with gangsters. They're willing to pay top dollar because essentially they're having their money laundered. Michael Cohen has to know some of what's been going on around this. He's been Trump's lawyer for more than 10 years.
Should we be at least skeptical of anything that Michael Cohen says, even though he's now cooperating with the investigation?
Well, there's no question he's lied in the past. And I think when you do this kind of investigation, you enter a world where the only people, the only knowledgeable people are dubious characters who may have criminal records. Felix Sater's a twice convicted felon. And Michael Cohen has clearly lied again and again. He'd say he'd take a bullet for Donald Trump, and here he has already turned on him. So no, I don't think you should take any of these people at their word. But Michael Cohen was the lawyer. He's taped hundreds of these conversations that have to do with these business relationships, and he has documentation. So he's a very interesting source.
Does he have business relationships with Russian oligarchs?
Well, he has had some very questionable relationships himself, especially in Florida. He had an offshore casino running on a boat for many years that was tied with some questionable Russians who appeared to have ties to the Russian mafia. And through his in-laws, the way he knows Felix Sater, Michael Cohen married a Ukrainian woman, as did Michael Cohen's brother, Brian Cohen. And through their father's in-law, they were connected to various oligarchs tied to the Russian mafia.
Let's talk about Paul Manafort as well. Obviously, Michael Cohen seems to be the biggest news this week, but Paul Manafort and the guilty verdict against him is also pretty significant and maybe even more in some ways closer to the story that you tell in your book, House of Trump, House of Putin. First off, any thoughts on what happened with the ending of this first trial for Manafort this week?
It turns out there was at least one hardcore Trumpster on the jury, and Manafort would have been convicted on all 18 counts if that guy had not been on the jury. However, Manafort did prevail, and this is the kind of battle we're going to see again and again, and it's a crucial victory for Robert Mueller, because Paul Manafort is now in a position where he has a choice. He can spend the rest of his life in jail, or he can rat out Donald Trump. He's got to make that decision, and we'll see how that unfolds. I don't know the answer.
Well, yesterday, Donald Trump was asked in a Fox News interview whether he would pardon Paul Manafort. He didn't say yes or no, but he went on to praise extensively Manafort.
Right. I'm not surprised about that. And one of the questions we're going to see again and again is, if Trump pardons people, can they then be retried in state jurisdictions? I don't know the answer to that in this Manafort case, but early on in the Mueller operation, Mueller began sharing data with the state attorney general of New York. He's done that in other jurisdictions as well. And I think what's going on is he's trying to spread out the investigation into different jurisdictions. So if Trump goes ballistic and fires Robert Mueller or Rod Rosenstein and tries to defang Mueller, if he tries to take away Mueller's security clearance, which would effectively make it impossible for Mueller to work, there are other jurisdictions in which the prosecutions will proceed.
Craig Unger, can you tell me about the backstory of Paul Manafort and even going back to the 1980s when he was part of a firm called Black, Manafort and Stone? And the Stone part of that is none other than Roger Stone.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, it's wonderful watching Donald Trump say, oh, I barely knew Paul Manafort. He only worked for me for, I think at one point Trump said 49 days. Well, the truth is he's known him at least 38 years. And in 1980, Manafort first began to work for Trump, and Manafort, this was Black Manafort Stone, the very firm you're talking about, and they helped Trump make some headway as he was trying to get into the gaming industry in New Jersey. At the time, that firm was very famous. There was a wonderful story in Spy magazine many, many years ago. It sort of satirized the whole thing because they were sort of known as the dictator's lobby or the torturer's lobby. And Roger Stone, who you mentioned, just reveled in the sleaze. He delighted in saying, we've got another sleazy dictator we're representing. And what happened to Manafort, Manafort kept taking it one or two steps further. And in 2006 and 2010, he represented Viktor Yanukovych, who became both president and at one time prime minister of Ukraine. And we also saw a huge number of dirty tricks on the part of Manafort back then. He started creating phony think tanks and planting fraudulent articles in various newspapers that would help Yanukovych and Putin's cause. This, in many ways, to me, was almost a dry run for putting another pro-Putin president in place. There are an awful lot of peas in that sentence. And that happened to be in 2016 when he put President Trump in the White House, who again appears to be doing Vladimir Putin's bidding.
Paul Manafort's a really interesting character once you get into his story. I almost see him as this decade's own version of a Jack Abramoff, even in the importance that he had in the lobbying world going back even to the 1980s. My understanding about Paul Manafort is that he got his rise by connecting himself to the campaign of Ronald Reagan and the presidency for Ronald Reagan, and that he was one of the young lobbyists at the time that changed the lobbying game, whereas before, what a lobbyist do is what I think we still think they do is they would lobby for some special interests and the goals of that special interest and go into Congress and lobby lawmakers for that interest and what that interest wants. But what Paul Manafort did was he aligned lawmakers with that interest. In other words, meaning he would start grooming candidates for office to where there's already the connection between the candidate and that special interest, which may seem like a subtle distinction, but probably an important one.
No, I think it is a paradigmatic change. I mean, his greatest triumph, of course, is you talk about a candidate aligned with a lobbyist's interest. Donald Trump is aligned with Putin's interests. And you can almost see this whole scandal in terms that are legal. There's a wonderful maxim that sometimes the biggest scandals are the things that are legal, not illegal. And you mentioned Jack Abramoff. This goes back easily to the 90s that Russians understood our lobbying system. And as you say, the special interests in the past might have been big oil or the big pharmaceutical industries. Well, now it's Vladimir Putin. And Manafort has been lobbying for those kinds of interests. And the candidate he helped install is Donald Trump.
Paul Manafort would become an important lobbyist for foreign governments in the 1990s. With the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right. One thing I started to do in this, I started to see the Cold War in very, very different terms. And that is, everyone assumes we won the Cold War, and it ended with the demise of the Soviet Union. But if you read my book, you can see that the KGB was sort of laying in wait. They were laying low, waiting to see how things sorted out. And Russia took enormous blows during this period. Putin has said again and again that the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe in world history. And after that, one East Bloc country after another joined NATO. But Russia was laying low, the KGB was laying low, and in my book you sort of see the KGB starting corporations that trade in commodities and so forth, but they really intend to serve Russian intelligence interests when the sleeping bear of Russia reawakens, and that's what's happened now.
We see a number of presidential bids by Donald Trump since year 2000. None of them are taken very seriously. Even the 2016 one wasn't taken very seriously at first. Do you see connections with Russian oligarchs and Donald Trump in his previous presidential runs?
It's not as clear early on. What I see is more that they are helping him financially. I see they are targeting him. They're setting him up. I see him as being very easy prey, to be honest. When I talked to General Oleg Kalugin, he told me about Trump's first trip to Russia. And remember, Kalugin was with the KGB back then. And Kalugin told me, and I'm going to quote this, is I would not be surprised if the Russians have, and Trump knows about it, files on him during his trip to Russia. So if you look at the whole narrative and look at Donald Trump's ties to Russia, again, I found 59 contacts, 59 different people. If you see it through a 30-year prism, you see that they're setting him up. And it always starts with a casual conversation. That's what General Kalugin told me. They start by flattering him. And believe me, Donald Trump is susceptible to flattery. He says so himself. So they told him, oh, you did such a wonderful building in New York. Let's do it in Moscow. And then when he gets there, according to Kalugin, they provide him with women, and they're secretly taping everything. That's the way it begins. Think about racketeering. Think about ongoing criminal enterprises. Think about money laundering. Again, it's very, very hard to prove what is in his mind. I think there are a number of crimes, potential crimes here. The one place where I was able to get inside Donald Trump's mind, if that's accurate, is he gave sworn depositions under oath in a trial. He was asked about Felix Sater, who he partnered with, and Sater had been convicted of two felonies. So from that deposition, we know that Trump was knowledgeable that he was partnering with a felon. And he continued to conceal that fact from investors, and he ended up profiting from this. That can be bank fraud. It's a possible case for bank fraud. There are a lot of questions that need to be explored legally.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
Are we ready?
This is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time. Around.
Are we ready?
Ready.
Uh-huh.
Let's go, dude.
Present, but not voting. In a minute.
Before we begin, are there any announcements?
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
KPFA town hall meeting was held yesterday. We'll be.
No, that's not what the announcement is, I think. What's the announcement?
KPFA town hall meeting will be held yesterday.
Is that next yesterday or this yesterday?
Siri, was there a town hall meeting yesterday?
Recorded minutes of the August 18, 2018 town hall meeting have been posted on kpftx.org.
Say again, where?
At kpftx.org in the archive.
Why wasn't I told about this? I love town hall meetings.
Announcements were made. Some listeners didn't hear about it. But apparently a leaker broke it, and too many people showed up, so it wasn't really a secret town hall meeting. Protesters complained about program changes.
What program changes?
Guns and Butter was canceled. I can't say more.
Why did that happen?
I didn't do it. There was an avalanche of two angry listeners who demanded it. But there were many reasons. For the last 17 years, that program, Guns and Butter, brought in too many donations. Too many new subscribers can increase revenue and ruin the voluntary bankruptcy plan to peel off KPFA from the Pacifica network. In times of struggle, disunity is the only answer.
Does transparency mean anything to you?
Oh, can we please stop talking about this? It had to be done in secret. Nothing gets done in public session.
You are listening to TwitWit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. We are going to open the discussion. Questions or comments?
Why are the subscribers always in the dark?
The subscribers own the assets, yes. This is a community membership organization, but I have sat on many boards, and I can tell you, the members do not want to see how the sausage gets made to get into voluntary bankruptcy decisions. That has to be done in secret to get the job done.
The job?
Who made you the chair?
It doesn't matter. We all want the same thing.
No, we do not all want the same thing. I want an independent program council with teeth.
Well, you can't have it. Professional program directors are better than community volunteer program councils. Give me a break. Some programs have to be censored to keep the community safe from crossing the line into dangerous and unscientific ideas that I don't like.
It's like critical thinking, but without the thinking.
We all do better when we all do better. We need to change the bylaws to make it legal, because there is no substitute for dialectical materialism with a socialist cover story.
I'm going to pray for you, dear.
Prayer is so naive. But go ahead, knock yourself out. Item 2, liquidating the assets.
The membership will block you.
WBAI is worth millions. So think of the good things we can do with all that money. But first, we have to lower the temperature of the discussion and sign this pledge to seek a smaller governance structure.
Should I sign this?
Don't sign it. It's a trick. Voluntary bankruptcy will disenfranchise the subscribers and reduce our impact.
Who actually owns the stations?
You and me. The listeners have 70 years of subscriber equity. Pacifica Radio can't be dismembered.
We tried listener democracy, and it hasn't worked. Management professionals know better than elected subscribers. I've already done the paperwork. Now, everybody, please sign at the bottom.
Don't sign.
Caller on line 2.
Go ahead, caller.
I'm calling on behalf of a prospective buyer who may or may not be Pierre Omida.
Keep talking.
Would you accept $137 million for the East Coast broadcast rights?
Hold up. Okay, I got you on speakerphone.
Hi, Pierre.
Who's on the call?
The finance director who knows nothing about broadcasting.
Actually, I'm the interim finance director.
Do you know what a spreadsheet looks like?
The membership will block you.
$137 million for the East Coast broadcasting rights. The licenses.
But if we sell the sister stations, who's going to expose you?
Absolutely, yes. Did you produce We the People in L.A.?
Well, this network kept Jerry Brown's name on the air. Now he's governor again.
We the People became Meet
okay,
the Weasel.
We have to wrap this up. First, we sell off New York and D.C. operations. Then we use the money to purchase the broadcasting rights for California. After I receive your signature, $137 million will arrive in your bank account from the Security Exchange Invisible Union Bank.
Security Exchange Invisible Union Bank? I have never heard of it.
Bridget, quick, I have Eric Schmidt here.
What is your end game?
A radio network that serves as a platform for electing corporate Democrats for the next 100 years. The people need candidates to believe in who I can trust. Bye-bye, sweetheart.
He's such a nice man.
You have a thing for Pierre Omidyar?
Well, he's not my type, but I might have his baby.
The music is Gracie and Rachel. I'm Berkeley Kidd. We're talking about voluntary bankruptcy and the cancellation of Guns and Butter on KPFA.
What is the difference between a volunteer bankruptcy and regular bankruptcy?
It's the difference between jumping off a cliff when you don't need to and being thrown off a cliff by forces beyond your control.
Don't jump.
Jump! Jump! Jump!
There's a movement now pushed by companies like Unisys here in the United States. They are pushing online voting. That's right. You won't have to go to a voting place. You won't have to use a voting machine. You'll do it all from your computer. The problem with this, as has been testified by countless experts, is that hackers, whether they be individuals or more likely your political enemies or even possibly the Secret Service of one or another country, will get in there and manipulate the votes. That's right. We go through this ritual of voting. It's already a joke as money is used to buy votes directly or indirectly. But now we have the specter of the computerized voting in which somebody sitting in an office somewhere will cast or rearrange whatever other people have actually cast as ballots to mean something else. If you're interested in learning about this and in learning how and why to fight it, verifiedvoting.org is the place to go.
The voice is Richard Wolf. I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is TwitWit Radio.
But how can we be sure Dr. William Pepper isn't a Pentagon co-intel agent with a book deal who wants to exonerate U.S. military snipers positioned on the building across the street from Dr. King's motel room?
Hey, whose side are you on?
Does the truth take sides?
I have a question.
Oh, we are out of time. Next item? Volunteer bankruptcy. All in favor?
Hey.
The hayes have it. The motion passes, yes.
I said hey, not a.
I mean, you and Bernie Sanders can file an appeal. Next item, volunteer bankruptcy. All in favor?
Hey.
The hayes have it. The motion passes.
Voluntary bankruptcy is voluntary censorship.
How do you get that?
Well, censorship is wrong, dude.
Who is censoring who?
I hate Alex Jones.
Yeah, Alex Jones is a counterintelligence operation. He smears the truth with his disgusting and unlikable presentation of it.
I wish I had thought of that. Alex Jones had to be censored because most people can't stand him. He has an unpopular attitude.
Oh, definitely. I would censor him for his bad attitude and ugly speech.
You want to censor someone for having a bad attitude?
Having a bad attitude is a privilege, not a right. A lot of so-called truths have very bad attitudes. This network has a long history of conspiracy mongers. I remember Mae Brussels.
Who is Mae Brussels?
Matthew Lazar on line one.
Go ahead.
Arguments. I remember when I was a volunteer at Pacifica Station, KPFA in Berkeley, back in the 1980s. Really tense conversations going on, you know, group conversations going on at KPFA about whether or not to run Mae Brussels.
The CIA is still being using the news media. United Press, CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting, the Hearst newspapers, and Reuters have all worked and still work for the CIA. The article is clouded by Carl Bernstein.
It's a really interesting question. I used to get really bent out of shape about this a lot at the Pacifica stations. But one of the things I began to notice is that these days, you know, everybody runs conspiracy theories. You know, everybody runs crazy stuff.
They never went into the subject of Howard Hughes at the time of Watergate or the killing of J. Edgar Hoover or the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne or the shooting of George Wallace.
Ancient aliens. I mean, it's like everybody's running this stuff now. Marilyn Monroe and Princess Diana.
I don't consider Carl Bernstein a flaming investigator. He covers the field and he covers up.
To this day.
And then it was Gerald Ford.
The voices are Matthew Lasser and Mae Brussels. I'm Berkeley Kidd. This is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Town hall meetings are hard to control. Everyone gets to say whatever they want until someone says time's up. I volunteer to be timekeeper.
Show us the books.
Why was there no audit for all this time?
Deliberate sabotage.
Not having the audit done on time for that last 3 years was a strategic decision, having nothing to do with my lack of experience running a national radio network into the ground. God, I did what I had to do.
You betrayed the members.
I was voted onto this board by the members. If you oppose my management, then you run a candidate to oppose voluntary bankruptcy in the next board election. If we have board elections after the new bylaws are approved.
Approved by who?
My faction on the paid staff. Put your hand down. I will call on you when we are out of time.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Hello, I'm Daniel Bordstrom, and I want to thank Bonnie for her 17 years of getting stories behind the stories. I want to thank her for that. I understand she has been taken off the air by Quincy McCoy, and that we're having a town hall meeting, and I believe he's not here. Did I hear it right? He's on vacation? Did I hear that right? Okay, he is on vacation. Why not make his vacation permanent?
To the person who spoke earlier and said what we are supporting. What we are supporting is free speech. That's what KPFA I have always thought was part of. That's why I donated, I believe it was 45 years ago, and had a sticker on my car that said KPFA, because we support free speech, which includes unpopular speech. It is very important that we have the chance to hear many different viewpoints, many different facts, and to dispute those facts openly and publicly. That's what we are here to support, and that is what was not done by the station manager, by the station management. There was no due process. There was no public involvement. Somebody was taken off after 17 years of archives removed because they didn't like some of the speech that was on that program. We oppose that. We want the program reinstated. We want proper procedures and free speech at KPFA. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've heard 3 times a compliment on the size of the crowd. It kind of makes me feel kind of dirty, you know what I'm saying? Because I frankly resent having to be here this afternoon to come in here and have to support somebody who has done excellent programming, a hell of a lot of which I disagree with, by the way, that does not necessarily always reflect the opinion of the program host. You want to fix that problem, make the disclaimer. Or throw out one of the bad programs. I don't care. But I've been heartbroken for the last 2 years, but because I've had to watch our public land be sold off to rich freeloaders by the ignorant jackbutt in chief. And now I have to tolerate watching one of our best programmers be thrown off the air because of comments like the one that I just heard from Philip. I may not be able to do anything about it, but I can restrict my future contributions to the $25 basic membership fee, and I will.
I'm speaking in support of Bonnie Faulkner and the Guns and Butter program. It takes great courage to challenge the dominant culture or thinking, and if we wanted to listen to the mainstream radio, there's plenty of other stations that offer it. I do not agree with everything on the program, nor do I agree with everything on every other program that is on KPFA. By taking this action, you alienate not only a group of dedicated listeners, but you also send a chilling message to other program hosts. Therefore, I say, you know, don't demand that they toe the line or they're off the air. Reinstate Guns and Butter, reinstate the archives, create a policy that is more democratic before summarily shutting down a program. It should not be done by 1 or 2 people only. It's too important. I'm a member of a multi-generational supporting family, and I will reduce my funding or cut it.
My name is Chuck Millar. Censorship is the worst, and KPFA, by and large, hasn't dealt with censorship all that much. However, Bonnie Bonnie has been a true hero for those of us who are against war. She's one of the first people who's entertained the whole idea of questioning 9/11, what it was about. And 9/11 is by and large the whole reason that we're in war. And the peace movement hasn't caught on to that because they don't want to deal with 9/11. Bonnie deals with it. We need her voice. She was willing to deal, to interview Gary Null about vaxxed and the whole issue about our kids being vaccinated and whether it's good for them or not. Who knows about that? It's a controversial issue. But she was willing to bring it out. KPFA censored that program and wouldn't let it be on the air. Now they're censoring her.
Thank you.
We need her back.
Thank you.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I produce Guns and Butter. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate everybody coming out. That's really nice.
Thank you.
I want to agree that KPFA is on a suicide mission. It's absolutely terrible. Canceling Guns and Butter is going to hurt the station immensely. The station has had three key personnel, long-term personnel, have quit. There are problems going on at the station. I would urge you in governance to take a look, to help the station, and to help get Guns and Butter back on the air. I sent out a newsletter at 6 a.m. yesterday morning, and within 12 hours, I received much more than 100 emails in support, people saying that they're not going to donate to the station. It's terrible. I got an email from a couple who said they had a legacy for KPFA. They're not going to do it. You guys need to turn this around. I'm not in governance. You are. And I hope that you will work with the station to put Guns and Butter back on the air, because this is not good for the station. If you care about KPFA, KPFA doesn't even have 1 hour a week buried in the afternoon for a deep political show, then what is it? What is a value at KPFA? I've dedicated 17 years of my life and spent all my money doing this.
Thank you.
And I've gotten no support from the station.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
I want to applaud everybody who came here to support Bonnie, and I want to also applaud those people who are courageous enough to stand up and have derision on that, to disagree with what she did, because that's the most controversial thing here today. Everybody supports her, but I want to also applaud the LSB for having this town hall and accepting these comments. In brief, I just want to say one thing. Bring Bonnie back. Bring Bonnie back. Bring Bonnie back. Bring Bonnie back.
of the dream, between the click of the light and the start of the dream, between the click of the light and the start of the dream, between the click of the light and the start of the dream.
This is the Berkeley Signal.